in the hospital with gunshot wounds, and the insurance won't pay for the extensive physical therapy he needs. The doctors are saying he could end up a paraplegic. I'm in the waiting room with Skylar and her sister Marie, Hank's wife, played by Betsy Brandt. Skylar says to Marie, Walt has the money to pay Hank's medical bills. For a minute, I think she's going to tell Marie everything. Oh, God. A look of panic flashes across my face. But then, to my utter shock and delight, Skylar comes up with an incredibly brilliant and elaborate lie that integrates shards of the truth and explains how we happen to have the tens of thousands of dollars needed to pay for Hank's treatment. Even I myself didn't understand the impact of Walt's diagnosis, Skylar tells Marie with wet eyes. It wasn't just that he was facing death. He was faced with the devastating knowledge that he was going to leave nothing behind for his family, less than nothing. He started gambling, Marie. He was good. He won. He paid for his treatment. We're suddenly rich. The writer created a great scene, a powerfully layered emotional triangle. I react to Skylar's lie first with alarm, and then shock, and then almost a kind of pride that she would go to this length to cover for me. I see my wife in a new light, and I like it. Marie is in teary disbelief, grateful and incredulous that meek, quiet Walter is not only a degenerate gambler, but also capable of raking in that much money. Skylar is in tears too. The last months have been so taxing and stressful for her. Even as she constructs this lie, she's overwhelmed by what she knows to be the truth. Her husband has become a drug kingpin. He's become a stranger. The moment marked a milestone for each of these characters. At first, Michael Slovis, our director, set it up the way it was described in the script. The three of us lined up in a row on a banquette seat, Skylar in the middle, and Marie and Walt on either side. We tried it that way, and as Skylar spoke to Marie, she had to turn her head back and forth between the two of us as if she were watching a tennis match. I couldn't catch an eye with Skylar to react to the initial shock of her lie or to help her build it as she went along. Marie had to crane around Skylar to look at me. We all agreed it didn't work as written. So Michael moved Skylar to a seat across from Marie, and he had me on a chair between the two sisters, forming a triangle. Now I could see Skylar tell her tale, and I could shift my eyes to monitor how it was being received, whether Marie was buying the lie. And Marie could easily look at me like, gambling? In my body language and eyes, I was able to shrug as if to say, yeah. Once we changed the seating arrangement, the scene became honest. It became fully realized. Off the actors went to allow the crew to do their work. Wondering what was taking so long to set up a pre-lit hospital scene, I came back an hour later and our first assistant director was outside. I asked what was holding us up. She made a phone symbol with her hand. They're calling Burbank on this, I said. How we reblocked the scene? She nodded. God damn it. That made me angry. I walked into the producer's office. The group was on the phone with the writer's room. Our director was in there trying to fight for what he had done. I said, is this conversation about the reblocking? It was. I said to our director, Michael, do you think it's the best thing? Yes, without a doubt, he said. I said, so do all three actors involved. That's the way we're going to shoot it. Let's go. We've got work to do. I was, rightly or wrongly, usurping control. Vince was on the phone, understandably a little upset. He said, if that's the way you're going to do it, there's nothing I can do. I said, Vince, that is the way we're going to do it because it's the best for the scene. As an actor early in my career, I didn't have the power or the confidence or the clout to emphatically and honestly state my opinion when I disagreed with the way things were going on set. Now I did, and I felt I did the right thing. The whole enterprise is about discovering the best way to tell the story. It's worth raising the hackles on occasion, when the integrity of the story is at stake. One disagreement doesn't affect the essential mutual respect Vince and I had for each other. We smooth things out later in person. Our spat wasn't unlike a couple's argument, natural, predictable, totally solvable. Heisenberg. I meet Mike, my one-time business partner, with the intention of getting the names of the informants he's been paying off in jail. I need that list. Those guys are a threat to my enterprise. They have to be dealt with. Instead of giving up the list, Mike is smug. He badgers me and tries to diminish me as a man. He tells me that my pride and ego have blown up the entire operation. He says everything would have remained good had I not tried to take over control. He says, you didn't know your place. He turns to leave. My place? The old me would have fumed inwardly and walked away. My pride and dignity shattered. But I've changed. I've become an impulsive, dangerous man. I'm Heisenberg, Walter's dark alter ego, his id. Heisenberg takes care of repugnant assholes like Mike. So many people have asked me, how did you get there? How could you be so evil? Jonathan Banks, who played Mike, was so terrific that, in a way, it was easy for me. I had a solid actor to react to. His belligerence lit the flame. I also called on the time I had been murderous. I conjured the rage and fear I'd felt when Ava was banging on my door. I didn't commit murder, but I believe I was close. It had been decades since then, but it was easy to summon the feeling. When it was time for Walt to kill Mike, I turned that old key. After he insults me, Mike walks toward his car. I seem rooted to the spot. But then, I'm walking. I haven't willed my legs to move. They're at the mercy of some automatic force. Suddenly, I'm standing at the driver's window, staring at Mike's blank face. Time comes to a stop. I fire. Done. Mike's car rolls forward and slams into a boulder. Mike manages to get out and limp into the bushes. I follow a trail of blood toward the river and find him sitting there on the banks of the Rio Grande, gazing blankly into the distance. He's still clutching his gun. As we were rehearsing the scene, Tom, the writer and director of the episode, said that he felt I didn't need to keep my gun trained on Mike. But that didn't make sense to me. I said, Mike's a known killer. He could raise his weapon at any time and shoot me. Tom disagreed. He thought Walt would recognize that Mike was resigned. Mike knew he was dying, so he didn't pose a threat anymore. That argument went against my instincts, so I kept the gun on Mike until I removed his weapon from his hand. We were working on location with natural light. We didn't have a lot of time to argue about the script's fine points. When the sun went down, our day would be over. I knew that, but I couldn't help raising another issue. After Walt takes Mike's gun away, the script called for Walt to say, I just realized that Lydia has the names. I can get them from her. Why do I say that? I asked. It's a shift of audience allegiance away from Walt, Tom said. I knew he was getting irritated with me, and he wasn't wrong. I was taking up time, the one commodity we couldn't replace. I said, but you're going to get a shift of the audience's allegiance anyway because I just shot a very popular character. That's enough to sway them away from me. After Walt shoots Mike, he knows he fucked up. Saying that he could have gotten the names from Lydia just makes him look like a huge asshole. I understood they wanted not only to turn the allegiance away from Walt, but onto Jesse. When we were together, partners, it was easy for the audience to root for us as a unit. As the rift grew between us, the allegiance was split. By the end of the series, the intent was to sway the audience from Walt to his former student. But having Walt say to no one in particular, you know what, I just realized I didn't need the names. That went against the sophistication of the show, the nuance of the character. Instead of savoring another emotionally taut and complex situation, you were left thinking, what a jerk. That's not where I felt the character should go. That's not where the writers wanted the character to go, in my opinion. I was afraid the audience would scoff, blanch, cringe. Much better to have Walt realize he let his impulses get the better of him. Look with horror at Mike, who has collapsed dead. Oh my God, what am I going to do? You'd still have the audience hating Walt's actions, but they'd be ambivalent about the man himself on the razor's edge. The guy gives in to his impulses, his ego. It's horrible, but it's human. The muddy water of the Rio Grande trickled by. We were losing daylight. Jonathan Banks was getting upset. This was his final scene. He was going to die in this scene, and he was not going to have the time to do it properly. It wasn't fair to him, and it was my fault. I should have brought the issue up earlier. I wish I had, but it just didn't hit me until that moment. I felt I had to bring it up. Feeling the pressure, I offered a compromise. I'd say the line, but as a function of Walt's anxiety. I still felt uncomfortable saying it, even after I made that adjustment, so I wanted another take where I expressed my anxiety by pacing like a caged panther. Tom agreed. We shot the scene, and then I let it go. No hard feelings. When the episode finally aired, I watched with Robin. We normally watched Breaking Bad together, though mostly watched in daylight. She couldn't stand to see the show before bed. Nightmares. I told Robin nothing of this dispute. I wanted to see how she would react without leading the witness. I trust her instincts. I respect her opinions. And I had a feeling I knew what was coming, but I didn't know for sure. I still thought, maybe their way is a stronger choice. But when the scene came up, when I said the line I hated, Robin scoffed derisively, as I worried she would. She turned her gaze from the TV to me, rolled her eyes, and pshawed, "What an asshole." Not an asshole for killing Mike, no. An asshole for not caring that he killed Mike. It pained me. But it's such a subjective business. Tom may have watched that episode and thought the beat was perfect. In the collaborative process, sometimes there are differences, sometimes there are battles, sometimes you lose. In all of the hours making Breaking Bad, I only got upset a handful of times. I think any family would wish for so few arguments. The quality of the writing on the show was so superb we didn't have to fight. We knew from day one we were all working together to build something of deep quality. So when we did fight, the arguments were always about the integrity of the show and its characters. It was never about early call times or trailer size. It was, is this working? Can we do better? Difficult. Sometimes actors get that label if they raise a question. As a producer, when I hear someone is difficult, I ask, difficult how? I worked with Oscar-winning actor Cloris Leachman on Malcolm in the Middle. She played the not-so-lovable Grandma Ida and won an Emmy for her performance. Before I worked with her, I heard rumors that she was difficult. In reality, she was like a bumblebee, vibrating with ideas. She was fun and theatrical and talented, and I just loved being around her. She brought so much energy to the set, and it was always about the work. She's also a nut. A certified lunatic in all the lovely ways she can be. One day we were doing a scene and she said, I gotta pee. Right now? We were shooting. We were on a tight schedule and she was gonna walk off to go pee. She shrugged and grabbed an empty paper coffee cup and just squatted down in front of everyone and tinkle, tinkle. Like she was camping. And then she handed the cup to one of our wardrobe people. Let's get on with it. So yes, she's quirky, but difficult? No. She channels her creative energy to serve the character and the story. She works at it and comes in very prepared. I don't call that kind of actor difficult, as opposed to the actor who comes in and says, there's no goddamn almond milk, or I'm not doing the scene, it's too cold outside, or don't ever give me direction. That is difficult. Difficult and creatively engaged are not the same. Having an engaged, invested cast and crew comes through on a molecular level. Even as a casual viewer, you can feel that kind of care. On Breaking Bad, the storytelling complex did not end at the writers and directors and actors. The electricians and technicians, the gaffers, the production assistants were all part of what made the show work. Everyone was all in, proud to be a part of the show. Stu Lyons, our producer, got calls every day from crew members all over New Mexico and Arizona who said, "I'm dying to work on the show." Our attrition level was very low. Once people got hired, no one wanted to leave. Even guys who were ready to retire said, "Not until the show was over." I remember shooting the scene in the last episode when Walt says goodbye to his daughter. He leaned down over the crib and touched his baby's soft sleeping head. This was the last time I'd see her. This was goodbye, forever. As I was leaning over the crib, my eyes welling, I saw Andy Vogelei, the camera operator who was shooting me from below. He was shaking, trying his damnedest to stay unemotional and hold the camera still, but he couldn't. He was a new father himself, and the moment got to him. He wiped tears away as he was shooting. We hugged when the scene was over. We all hugged one another, often. That was the culture. We showed our love and concern for everyone. It was very sweet and real and rare. Producer. At the beginning of the show, I was told that Jesse Pinkman would not be a series regular. He wasn't going to live past the second or third episode. He was designed to hook me up with the drug culture, and then he'd be killed. But because everyone adored Aaron Paul and loved his work, and because he and Walt were perfect foils to each other, Jesse became much more than a gateway into the drug world for Walt. Their relationship became, in many ways, the emotional core of the show. They had nothing in common: age, values, education, style of dress. As Jesse might put it, "Mr. White is this big homo and tidy whiteys, yo." And Walt thought that Jesse is a ridiculous imbecile. Their friction created comedy and a kinetic strange bedfellows, opposites attract, father and son dynamic. When they first became partners, they shared nothing except mutual dependence. But ultimately, they came to love each other in their own way. Aaron Paul was a shiny-eyed kid in his mid-20s when I first met him. He was a puppy. He was attentive and playful and honest and present and vulnerable and richly talented. Right from the pilot, it was clear that we had the makings of a great on-screen chemistry. And off-camera, Aaron and I got along very well. He looked up to me, and I saw something of myself in him, a youthful energy, hopefulness. As our dynamic within the storyline varied and evolved, we became even tighter outside of work. That Breaking Bad ride bonded us deeply. He's a friend for life. Every year, Aaron and I would rent out the Silva Lanes bowling alley in Albuquerque and host the cast and crew and their families. Food, open bar, karaoke, and of course, bowling. In 2011, amid the revelry and silliness, someone whispered into my ear, "Osama bin Laden was just killed. Navy SEALs had crept into his lair in Pakistan and taken him out, more than a decade after 9/11. The day we thought might never happen had finally come. I was behind the counter on the public address system in the process of issuing the next bowling challenge, so I incorporated this news into my remarks. "Okay, there are three announcements to make. First, any kid under 12 who gets a strike wins a plush toy. Second, the Navy SEALs have killed Osama bin Laden. And third, the next adult to get three strikes in a row wins a Breaking Bad DVD box set. Good luck." A stunned silence. I let the news sink in, and then I said, "I'm not joking. Anyone who gets three strikes in a row wins the Breaking Bad DVDs." I went for the joke, my default. When the laughter faded, I went back to the PA. "And that thing about Osama bin Laden is also true. They got him." I'll never forget the energy in the room at that moment. Pride, shock, vengeance, relief. People were cheering, hugging. A few cried. I'll never forget where I was that night. It always comes back to me viscerally, the smell of beer and bowling alley wax, and the disinfectant they spray in the rented shoes, the easy feel of camaraderie among the cast and crew, the looks of raw surprise and elation on the faces in the crowd. It should have been a happy night, but then there was Steve. Steve had been trying to get on our crew for a while, and finally in our fourth season he was hired as a production assistant. Steve was effective and professional. He clearly knew his way around a film set, and he caught on to protocol quickly. And then came bowling night. Steve got so wasted that his face went slack. He lurked around the bowling alley, approaching women and commenting on their bodies in lascivious terms. His targets included Betsy Brandt and Lauren Parsikian, who would soon become Aaron Paul's wife. Aaron and I organized those nights to show appreciation for everyone's hard work. We were a celebrated show by that point, and a few names like Aaron and Vince and I got the lion's share of the accolades. But the truth was that every single person who worked on the show played a part in making Breaking Bad what it was. And that night was meant for us to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts to our community, our family. Steve's crude behavior would have been reprehensible on any night, but on this night especially, it was a disrespectful affront. It also went against everything we cared about and stood for. I didn't find out about Steve's behavior until the next day. Betsy told me. "Steve will have to be fired," I said. "Oh," Betsy said in her compassionate way, "is it possible to just have him work in some other area of the show and not be around me?" "No, that is not possible," I said. "We can't have someone working on our show whom you have to worry about running into. He's got to go." I remembered the shame I felt when I got fired from the Canoga Park Chronicle. All those newspapers I had thrown in the dumpster. I hadn't even known I was stealing. I felt humiliated by my ignorance, my failure. And when Joe Stewart called me into his office on Loving to say, "Story-wise, we're going in a different direction." All the times people had said, "We're going another way, away from you." I remembered feeling crushed. I remembered the self-doubt and how it lingered. I had never thought much about what it would be like to be on the other side. I hadn't needed to. Now I did, and I didn't like it. But I told myself, this isn't akin to Joe's hatchet jobs on the set of Loving. This isn't the Canoga Park Chronicle canning a kid taking shortcuts. This is serious and necessary and just. No question. I called Aaron. Lauren had told him about Steve's behavior, and he was livid. Of course he was livid. Still, I was taken aback. In the 6 years of shooting the show, I couldn't recall seeing Aaron Paul angry one other time. He was capable of gut-wrenching menace and emotion and danger as an actor, but his true nature was gentle and kind. I had no question about how to proceed before I heard Aaron's voice, but now I felt a new urgency. We had to fire Steve immediately. I called Stu Lyons, our experienced, pragmatic line producer. A line producer handles the business end of the production, the operations, working out the cost of trucks, confirming permits for locations are set, making sure the caterers are there, and so much more. Stu was ahead of me. He had already dismissed Steve earlier in the day. News travels fast. Harassment, especially sexual harassment, is not tolerated. Stu told me that he urged Steve to seek professional help, not just for his future job prospects, but also for himself personally. Later, we learned that Steve was an alcoholic. He had been spinning out of control, and that night at the bowling alley had been one in a series of nights. I felt for him. I hoped he would get help. But there was no way we could let him be a part of what we were trying to do. We couldn't let anyone put at risk this thing that we'd worked so hard to create. Crime victim. Albuquerque was as central to the show as any person or character. Shooting there, I got to know the place well. Its friendly people, stark beauty, and quirky charms that will always have a place in my heart. Even though it's New Mexico's largest city, Albuquerque is a small town, really, set in a wide valley in the high desert, flanked on the east side by the Sandia Mountains. Sandia means watermelon in Spanish. And it's true that the mountains take on a gorgeous watermelon hue when they catch the glow of the setting sun. Sandia Crest is the highest point in Albuquerque, about 10,500 feet above sea level. During the spring and summer, whenever I had a day off from work, I would hike the area. Crisp air, pine trees, strenuous trails. Not what you'd expect when you think of the desert. But at this elevation, the topography changes completely. During winter, there is snow. I drove up to the top one winter day. An observation platform allows for a 360-degree panoramic view of Albuquerque to the west, Santa Fe to the north, and vast deserts to the east and south. It's a beautiful thing to stand up high and see the great seam where nature and civilization meet. But it's cold at 10,500 feet, so I couldn't stand it for more than a few minutes before it was back to the car. Only when I got inside my warm car, it wasn't so warm. I noticed bits of glass on the dashboard. I looked over and saw a gaping hole in the passenger side window. My shoulder bag was gone. I jumped out of the car and looked around. The only people nearby were a family I had seen earlier taking pictures. Could it have been them? They shrugged and said they hadn't seen anyone near my car. I had been gone maybe 5 minutes, and the parking lot was visible from the observation deck, only about 40 yards away. I'd been looking in the very direction of my car when it happened. My shoulder bag was gone. Shit. The contents included my iPad, plus a hard copy of the second episode of our last season. I contacted our studio, Sony, to tell them about the script and the two other electronic scripts on my iPad, and then drove to the sheriff's station in Tijeras. It was closed. Small town. Taped to the door was a note. This station is closed during off hours. If this is an emergency, call 911. If this is not an emergency, call, a local number was given, and leave a detailed message of the incident. Include your name, spelled out, and your contact information, and a sheriff's deputy will return your call soon. Thank you. As I drove to the dealership to get the window repaired, I called the non-emergency sheriff's line and left my detailed message as instructed. Blah, 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 blah. My name is Cranston, C-R-A-N-S-T-O-N. I left my number and hung up. Then in January 2013, we were shooting a scene in the episode titled Tahajali. Walt pays a visit to Andrea, beautifully played by Emily Rios, to convince her to lure Jesse over to the house so that neo-Nazis can kill him for his treachery. He had broken the one rule criminals hold dear. You don't rat. It was a bright day in Albuquerque when Ollie, one of our great grips on the show, said to me, "Hey, did you talk to that guy who's working as an extra with us today?" "No," I said. "Why?" "Because he spoke to the dude who broke into your car and stole your stuff." I walked over to the guy who was sitting in his car. That day was actually his car that was an extra, driving up and back on a street during takes. Movies and TV shows always use this technique for filming. Without background people and cars controlled by the production, the frame would look empty and unreal. I introduced myself and asked him about what Ollie had told me. He hesitated at first, but after a few minutes he broke down and said, "We were hanging in a strip club Wednesday morning." "Hanging in a strip club on Wednesday morning?" "Yeah. And the dude comes up and says, 'Hey, I got some Breaking Bad stuff. You interested in buying?'" He told me that he mentioned to the dude that he occasionally works on the show. And the dude just took off. I asked if he knew the dude's name. After some hesitation, he said, "Yes, his name is Xavier." I said, "Do you know where I can find Xavier?" He said that Xavier was currently being held at the downtown MDC, Municipal Detention Center, on another charge, and that he thought that Xavier comes from a whole B&E family. That's what they do. A family. I thought back to the family I'd seen on the mountain. Was that family Xavier's? I relayed this information to the sheriff's office immediately. They moved quickly to question Xavier and charged him, and the case moved through the system with glacial speed. I don't know if the guy who was working with us that day, the extra, was right about Xavier's family, but eventually I heard that Xavier got a year of home confinement for this crime and two others. The punishment seemed light to me, but maybe a brutal stretch of wearing an electronic ankle bracelet would teach him a lesson. Later, in March of 2013, as we were shooting the very last episode of Breaking Bad, the break-in story broke over what seemed like every possible news outlet. Networks, local stations, websites, blogs, everywhere. Final episode script of Breaking Bad was stolen. Wait, what? On Good Morning America, the anchor sat on the couch discussing this heinous crime, all hoping that the missing script wouldn't be revealed and spoil the ending. In other news, the dramatic audio tape of Bryan Cranston's 911 call for help. What? It wasn't a 911 call. I calmly followed instructions from the Mayberry-like sheriff station to the letter. But the world was told I'd hit the panic button. I even caught flack on social media for tying up the 911 system for a non-emergency. Untrue. Innocent, but guilty in the court of pop culture opinion. Walter White. The robbery at Sandia Crest didn't mar its beauty, and early on I said to Vince that it would be cool to shoot something up there. The landscape was so different in look and feel from our other locations around Albuquerque. An image of someone dragging a dead body through the snow came to me. I thought the juxtaposition of the red blood against the white snow would look striking on the screen. I don't know if Vince remembered me bringing it up, but we did indeed end up shooting there in the last season. When Walt was holed up in a cabin in New Hampshire, we used Sandia Crest as a stand-in for the Granite State. Walt is taken into the deep woods and told that he'll be apprehended if he leaves the property. Left alone, imprisoned in the snowy wilderness with only a barrel of money for company. A fitting end. Ed, the disappearer, shows up with supplies. I ask after my family, desperate to know how they are. Ed says that Skyler is working as a part-time taxi dispatcher for money and still has custody of the kids for the moment. She's using her maiden name, presumably trying to expunge any trace of the name White from her memory and resume. Robert Forster played Ed. Of course, I remembered Bob from 1979 when I was a production assistant in the special effects department on Alligator. I remembered stuffing plastic baggies of fake blood into the cavity of a pretend reptile, and I remembered how excited I was to do it. I remembered sitting in the van with him, shoulder to shoulder. How starstruck I felt. He was a famous actor. I was just a kid. But he'd been so kind to me. I'd never forgotten that. I'd run into him a few times over the years and reminded him of our encounter. He didn't remember. Didn't even pretend to. That's not Bob. And I didn't expect him to. In those last few days of shooting Breaking Bad with him, I reflected on the arc of Bob's career. He did it right. He understood the ebb and flow of this business. He is an accomplished movie star who now does smaller roles and enjoys every minute of it. He never developed a sense of entitlement. On the set, he said quite often, "Happy to be here." He meant it. In our last scene together, Walt offers Ed $10,000 to stay a couple hours and play cards with him. He's that desperately lonely. He just wants a little company. Deadpan, Ed doubles the fee and reduces the duration. Walt agrees. The price doesn't matter. What's money to him anymore? Ed deals the cards for five-card stud. The first two up cards randomly come up kings. The director, Peter Gould, hadn't yelled cut, so we both stayed in character and continued playing. Bob improvised and announced the cards. Two kings. The irony isn't lost on Walter White. For a short period of time, he felt like a king. Now? Aside from Ed's visit, I am alone in that cabin. Robinson Crusoe meets Scarface. I have a full beard. The cancer has come back. I can feel myself slipping away. Should I just wait for death to take me? Is this, after everything, the sum total of my works and days? A barrel full of money I can't use and can't get to my family? Everything for naught? I know my family is disgusted. I feel ashamed. I was hoping I could convince my son to find some measure of forgiveness in his heart, hoping I could say, "I was sorry." I was hoping I could find a way to leave them something. Money isn't everything, but it's a lot. My family needs it. There has to be a way to get it to them without the feds tracing it. I lay eyes on the box of Ensure meal replacement drinks Ed brought me to help to keep my weight up. I empty it and fill it with as much money as it will hold. I trudge through the thick snow, holding the box tight to my chest. I find a dive bar. I find a payphone. I call my son at school. I try to tell him everything. I was doing it for you, I tell him. I'm sending you the money so the feds can't trace it. I tell him once, I love you. I never want to see you again, he says. I want you to die. I weep. I feel the waste of my life. My good intentions got derailed by greed and hubris and rage and resentment. I was the danger, all right. A danger to myself, to everyone around me. So much pain and loss. I haven't left a mark. I've left a stain. I am nothing. I wept as we filmed that scene. When we finished, I was spent, exhausted and a bit traumatized. It was also my birthday. We shot Breaking Bad on 35mm film. Few shows, if any, do that anymore because of the expense. And the technology has improved so much that you can get similar quality on digital. We shipped the film back to the lab in L.A. as we shot it. Each day we knew when the flight that was carrying the film was leaving, and we had to break the film, box it up, and get it to the airport. A courier then picked it up at LAX and took it to the lab so that the next day the digital copies were ready. Assistants loaded them up so our editors could see what they had. That way, if there was a problem with the film, say, a scratch, we could still reshoot before we were long gone from that location. While the film of that wrenching scene with my son was being shipped from Albuquerque to L.A., it fell off the back of an airport luggage cart. Then one of those tank-like tows that push and pull airplanes to the gates ran over the film cans. The film didn't just get exposed, it got pulverized, ruined. The insurance company covered it, but we would have to go back and shoot the scene again. When I first heard that some film got ruined, I thought, oh please, let it be something like the scene where I walk into a store and put the milk on the counter, or a scene where I'm driving my Aztec, not the scene where I hear from my son that he wishes I were dead. But, of course. The day I had to reshoot that scene was challenging. I felt myself reenacting rather than acting. I remembered what I did the last time and tried to extinguish that from my mind, but it was hard. I needed to find a new path back to those depths, and I couldn't. But it had to be done, so we did it again, and again, and again. Acting, done well, is the ability to endure repetition. You're hysterical, do it again. You're experiencing the most piercing loss, do it again, and again. How to be honest and true and feel all those feelings on command, then repeat? You just do. It takes practice to get through, to communicate, to move your audience regardless of the problems. That's the job. So I wept, and wept again, and I found a new path. Walter White was more alive in the last years of his life than he had been in the previous 50. He went from utter failure to great power. In the final episode, Skyler says, "Give me a break. You didn't do it for your family." "You're right," Walter answers. "I didn't. I did it for myself. I did it for me. I liked it. I was good at it. And I was really... I was alive." He was. I don't agree with the decisions Walter made or the actions he took, of course. But I feel for him. If you have 2 years to live, you don't let them cut your balls off. You go out fighting. That's what he did. He was alive. And when I was doing the series, so was I. Saying goodbye to Breaking Bad was incredibly difficult. Doing the last episodes, the characters were all dying or driving off into the sunset. Walter was saying goodbye to Skyler, and from a distance he was watching his son get off a school bus. He was exchanging a final, meaningful look with Jesse. They both knew it was goodbye. And we knew, too. I was Brian saying goodbye to Aaron, and to Anna, and Betsy, and Dean, and RJ. This was likely the last time most of us would work together. I suppose you could be on a terrible show and still feel lost when it ends, but to be on a show that was so respected, not just by us, but by the world, and to feel so intensely connected to one another. We all knew we might never have that feeling again, but we had to move on. Goodbye, Walter. Rest in peace. Celebrity. I've seen Breaking Bad t-shirts in cities and little outposts all over the world. People dress as Walter White for Halloween. They dress their children and dogs in hazmat suits and Heisenberg hats. People have shaved my face into the back of their heads. They've inked it on their backs, their forearms, their legs, their asses. I'm the permanent resident of some guy's left butt cheek, next to Larry and Moe. I suppose I'm taking the place of Curly, the third stooge. It's a little odd to have your face tattooed on someone's backside. I did not see that coming when I lied about my ability to mountaineer in order to get a Mars bar commercial. I didn't even see it when we were shooting the pilot. A lot of people around us were raving. Profound, they said. Groundbreaking. We have a hit on our hands. Something very special and rare. But all I knew at the moment was that we were doing something daring, and we were having a good time. Nothing more. People tend to think that actors or writers or directors know when something is going to be a hit. We don't. We can guess. We can hope. We can do the work, but that's all. No one can know with certainty if a movie or a show is going to work, even if it's damn good. There are so many outside variables. Marketing, music, timing. Competition also determines if something succeeds or fails. Sometimes there's another movie about giant man-eating grasshoppers coming out the same weekend as your grasshopper movie. Social mores are another part of it. Sometimes a movie is ahead of its time, or maybe it's just a little behind. You just don't know. You keep your fingers crossed, but you don't know. The audience embraced Breaking Bad beyond anyone's wildest imagination, and that changed my life. I'd been a working actor for nearly my entire adulthood, and now, suddenly, in my 50s, I was a star. That's never what I aspired to be. I wanted to act. I wanted to work. Being an actor and being a celebrity are two different things altogether. For a long time, I had a real ambivalence toward fame and praise. Whenever someone gave me a compliment, I would downplay it, which would then have the unintended consequence of prompting the person giving the compliment to reiterate, "You were great." "No, I appreciate it, but no, I was okay." No, you were really great." "Well, I don't know. Thank you." I said thank you more as an apology than a genuine expression of gratitude or appreciation. I did it all the way through my 30s. Maybe I felt that because I didn't have a formal education, who was I to get these jobs? Who was I to receive this praise? I remember I bristled the first time someone called me a television star. No, I'm just an actor working on a show. The show could end at any time. At a certain point, I gave in. I realized I was spending a lot of time and energy pushing away fame. I realized how taxing it was. I realized I could just say thank you and appreciate it. And once I realized that, I got out of my own way. I had to come to terms with what was happening in my own life. Undeniably, I've benefited from fame. Many, many opportunities have come my way because of the insane success of Breaking Bad. But there are downsides, too. As an actor, you need to be sensitive, to be open, to be able to observe people and study human behavior. I don't want my character to be me, but with a hat. I have my Brianisms, and I study people to help get me away from those tics. But as a celebrity, I am no longer the observer. I am the observed. I am not the one who knocks. I am the one who ducks and covers. People who sell celebrity autograph material find out when your plane is landing, where you're staying, where you're eating, and they lie in wait, and they shove paraphernalia at you to sign. Many of the guys are aggressive. They bark at you. If you sign, they tell others, he'll sign. And then you're mobbed by even more people. And your time and energy get drained by this. And it's like you're going out there handing them money. And when you don't hand them money, they get upset at you. Of course, it couldn't be more different with real fans who just want to shake your hand and say that your show or film really touched them. I love that. I've become hyper aware of the catacombs, the secret exits, how to escape from any given place. I choose a hotel because I know it has a good backdoor situation. At an airport, if I'm not in a lounge, I'll look around and find old people and sit facing them. They're far less likely to know who I am. If there happens to be a conversation, I can count on a normal exchange. It's really cold outside. What time are we boarding? I go to a restaurant with my wife and daughter, and I sit with my back to the room so fewer people can see my face. When Taylor sees people whispering and pointing, she says, "Dad, you've been made." People rush up to my wife and me. "Oh my God, it's Walter White!" They hand my wife their cell phones. "Would you mind?" She's gracious, always, but it's uncomfortable at times. She'd never say anything. She realizes how lucky we are, what incredible gifts we've been given. But it's hard being a plus one. It shouldn't be that every invitation reads Bryan Cranston plus one. It shouldn't be that photographers wave her aside to get an unobstructed shot of me. I don't want her to feel unimportant. She's the opposite of that. I love work. I even love to work on my birthday, especially my birthday. It's like a gift I give myself. I've always believed in work, but because Breaking Bad ushered in an avalanche of new opportunities, my workload since the show ended has been enormous. Part of that is my nature. I want to do as much as I can while I can. I know that my career will slow down eventually. That's the natural cycle of things. And when that happens, I want to have no regrets. I want to know that I took full advantage of my good fortune. Even if I make mistakes along the way, I'd rather fail than regret. The other reason I work so much is that my work life is more protected than my non-work life. I asked Robert De Niro about it once. We were both at a hockey game at Madison Square Garden, guests of the New York Rangers. We had never met before, but between periods we were hustled into a green room, a protective area which is easier for security to guard. Otherwise, people would constantly come down to say hello or get an autograph. We got to talking, and I mentioned at some point that it seemed he worked nonstop. He said, "I just feel more comfortable when I'm working." If he's not working, it means he's stepping outside his apartment, walking down the street, being pointed to and stared at. He's Robert De Niro. How can he have a normal day, ever? As a celebrity, you can easily create your own kind of self-imprisonment. I think of the Alzheimer's ward where my mom spent her final years. You have your gardens and your walking path and your illusion of freedom, but you don't go beyond this wall. You're not really free. We were shooting the film Contagion in Chicago, and I was on the street with Lawrence Fishburne. We were done working for the day, and we wanted to go get a bite to eat. I commented that it was a nice night. It would be great to walk. But then I said, "I guess we should get a car so that we don't have to deal with the public attention." Fish said, "No, we can walk. You deal with it. You just don't stop moving." "What if there's a stoplight?" I said. "Just keep moving, wave, and then find a way around." And we did. Slowly, I came to understand why celebrities make celebrity friends. Because you can be yourself. Tom Hanks doesn't need anything from me. I don't need anything from him. We can relax in each other's company. After I saw his work in Captain Phillips, I told him his performance was so heroic yet deeply vulnerable. I told him it really affected me. It's not adulation or fawning. It's collegial appreciation on a human level. Since I became famous, my personality has changed. I tend to leave my house less. If I leave my house, I'm in a hat and sunglasses. And when I'm walking down the street and pass by a group of people, I'm looking down at my phone, pretending to be absorbed in it. If I don't happen to have my phone with me, I'll pretend to wind my watch or wipe dust off my sleeve, head down. Louis C.K. told me he feels the same thing, but he fights it. He tests himself, pushes himself out, but he always feels vulnerable, armorless. Every time I feel claustrophobic or hemmed in by my fame, I remember the first time I was nominated for a Golden Globe for Malcolm in the Middle. I was so excited and greatly honored. At the Beverly Hilton, they cordoned off the hallway that led from the ballroom to the parties. Once the ceremony was over, security would escort everyone out of the hallway and into the party rooms. Plenty of people on both sides of the rope would be asking for an autograph. We were told, please don't stop. If one actor stops and another doesn't, the one who doesn't is going to look bad. Please just nod and say hello and move into the party. Robin and I did as we were told. We walked the long gauntlet, waving and smiling, but ignoring all the requests. But about halfway through the lobby, we hit a bottleneck. The procession came to a dead stop. We were standing just a few inches away from 2 13-year-old girls. Please, please, please! They were leaning over the ropes, begging me, almost crying. It was like Beatlemania. I really can't. They told us not to. But please, please! I looked around. The line wasn't moving, and I said, okay, but don't tell anyone. I surreptitiously took their autograph books, and as I was about to write my name, one of the girls said, who are you? Robin and I burst out laughing. I wrote, with love, Tom Cruise. Visitor. Not too long ago, I visited a teenage boy, a huge Breaking Bad fan, at the Children's Hospital in L.A. Not long to live, I was told. The doctors couldn't do much more than make him comfortable. To be honest, I was dreading it. What could I do? I wasn't a doctor or a healer or even a speaker with a positive message. I was just an actor. I didn't know how I could help him or his parents. I was stressed. I wanted to be on time, and yet I didn't want to go at all. Robin and I parked the car, and I hurried toward the elevator. Can you come in with me? I asked. I needed support. Of course I'll come, she said. But as we walked down the corridor toward the kid's room, it started dawning on me. My dread and stress were selfish. This wasn't about me, how I felt. This was about Kevin. It was my responsibility to do whatever small thing I could for Kevin while I had the chance. I needed to get out of my head and focus on the boy. I took a few deep breaths. I had the same feeling I have when I'm standing backstage, before I make an entrance. I'm filled with nervous anticipation, but once I step on stage, it dissipates. And that happened the moment I entered the room. It was all right. I walked in and I said, hi, Kevin, casually, and he responded in kind. We exchanged ideas and thoughts, and I challenged him. I took the contrarian point of view. He said Walter White was evil. What? I said, pretending to be angry. You like Jesse? Why? Oh, you're crazy. That's insane. I started pacing, pretending he was driving me mad. The fact that he was ill did not come into the conversation. Except I told him he looked like Walter White with his bald head. He thought that was funny. You need to grow a mustache and a goatee. Can't you grow facial hair, kid? For a moment, it wasn't about his illness. It wasn't a doctor giving him more bad news or a nurse drawing blood. I was this guy on his favorite show, and we were together, alive in that moment. Statistician. Toward the end of Breaking Bad, I was deluged with scripts, and I had to devise a way to sift through, a system to evaluate them. In an order of importance, I weighed story, script, role, director, and cast. I assigned each project an evaluation number. 20 is a perfect score. 18 to 20, I must do it. 15 to 17, seriously consider it. 13 to 14, on the bubble. Below 13, pass. Here's how several projects scored. Argo, 19. Trumbo, 17. All the Way, 20. The Infiltrator, 15. Why Him, 14. Godzilla, 15. Wakefield, 16. The baseline is always the story. Good storytelling is timeless. It's the essential human art form. Civilians might look at a script and see a monologue of several pages and be scared by it. I could never memorize that. An actor reads it differently. Actors feast on challenging language. We are nourished by words. Role and director are important, of course, but story is essential. If the story isn't compelling and the writing isn't well constructed, it doesn't matter how great the character is. A legendary director like Ridley Scott is helming a project, but the story is, might be a no. Although that combination would be rare. Great storytellers know great scripts. Another factor is how supportive is the studio? Do I have a history with anyone attached to the project? Is there someone involved with whom I've always wanted to work? So many things can and do come into play. One criterion not on the scale, however, is money. I figure my agents are incentivized to make the best deal they can, so whatever they're happy with, so am I. Money is simply not a key factor in choosing projects. I never want to make a creative decision based on financial need. I keep my lifestyle within my means, so I don't have to do that. Of course, every now and then, an offer comes up that's too good to refuse. Like Super Bowl 2015. I was asked to shoot an insurance commercial that would have a one-time airing during the game and then never be played again on television. A woman comes in to see her pharmacist, and instead she encounters Walter White behind the counter. It was funny, and it paid a lot, a ridiculous amount. I thought I would be a fool not to take it. Accepting a commercial like that makes it possible for me to do super low-budget passion projects. I've been dead broke, and I've been rich, and rich is better. But now that money is less of an issue for me, I'm mostly about the quality of the work and the experience. Once Warren Buffett visited the Breaking Bad set to tape a sketch that would be played at his annual gathering of stockholders. The financial guru played a version of Heisenberg opposite Aaron Paul and me. A funny bit. On a break, I asked the same question that everyone asks Warren. What's your secret? Oh, it's no secret, he said, in his affable homespun way. Just make more right decisions than wrong ones and you'll be fine. The Cranston Assessment of Project Scale, CAPS, as I've called it, embodies that principle. I'm going to make mistakes, but the idea is to give myself the best chance to make more good decisions in the face of an overwhelming number of choices. Nephew. I heard from my aunt Sunday most often by snail mail. Postmark, Woodland Hills. A nice community close to my childhood home in Canoga Park. She and my father's brother, Eddie, had no children, no pets, no great friends. Aunt Sunday's adventures were vicarious ones she took on her lazy boy recliner. Every time I was mentioned in the TV guide, agent number three, obnoxious dinner guest, she got out her scissors. An inveterate clipper, she sent me every clipping, carefully folded into an envelope. I appreciated the thought, which didn't stop me from throwing the clippings in the trash. I can't bear clutter. I didn't see much of Sunday nor of Uncle Eddie. My brother ran into Eddie at the motion picture hospital when my mom was in intensive care, but Eddie wasn't there to visit Mom. If he hadn't bumped into Kyle, I don't think Eddie would have known or thought to ask of his former sister-in-law. That was 2006. 3 years later, I had wrapped the season of Breaking Bad and was back in Los Angeles. It was late at night and the phone rang. Your dad, Robin said. My dad still had stars in his eyes, but they were different stars, not acting stars, producing stars. I remember he produced a variety show, The New Sounds of Country. He had 6 or 7 country music acts. They were pretty good. One fresh face popped, and he sold that show into syndication. And many years ago, he came up with a precursor to the Country Music Awards. His version didn't stick, but the CMAs did. Over time, he sold one or two things, but it wasn't enough. He was constantly behind. Money was a daily struggle. I hated that whenever he called, I assumed he needed something. I always braced myself for the inevitable question, "Hey, buddy, do you think you can loan me a few grand? I hate to ask." I'm here in Woodland Hills, he said, his voice shaking. I knew right away it wasn't about money. He told me it had been a few months